welcome to episode 14 of the Midweek F1 podcast, brought to you by Diamond Bright, protecting, cleaning and caring for cars since 1992. Now, this is the podcast where we have the last look at the race just gone and the first look at the race coming up. It was a hell of a weekend in Spa. We have a lot of things to talk about. And I have to say, our shiny new sponsor, Diamond Bright, could not be more apt. I'm Nicola Hume. As always, I am joined by F1's Diamond Geezer, see what we did there, and the velvety smooth tones of Mr. Ben Edwards.
Thank you so much. Well, we've got so much to get into. There's been a bit of a gap, so we've been looking into on-track, off-track as well, and we're going to start with a look at what happened at Spa. So much interesting stuff.
Yeah, it was a wild weekend, but before we move on, make sure you subscribe. So wherever you're listening, then click follow. If you're watching on YouTube, click subscribe. Add some comments of your thoughts from the race weekend and what you think of the Hungary race that's going to be coming up next week. But look, I mean, that gap between Silverstone and Belgium, a lot of things have happened. We have a lot of things to talk about, right, Ben?
Absolutely. No, we do.
We have an unbelievable guest today. This is like a pinch yourself moment because we are joined on the podcast by former F1 driver and inspiration for Brad Pitt's character in the new F1 movie, Martin Donnelly, is joining us on the podcast.
Oh, it is great to have Martin with us. He was a star for me when I was doing some racing in my early years as well. So it'd be great to have him with us. And of course, we'll be talking to him about all sorts of things, including when we get into that we need to talk about feature about one of the rookies that we're still not 100% sure about.
Yeah. And then, of course, we've got our midweek F1 Championship of the World. Who did well after Spa? Not me. Find out later.
And then, of course, we're going to be diving into what's going to happen at that next race at the Hungara Ring. Who's going to win that one? Because then we can score some more points if possible.
Well, you had a good week. And that's okay. I'm okay for you feeling smug about that. That's perfectly fine.
It's very rare. But there you go.
Let's discuss Spa. There were rumours of rain and then it rained. And I would say it's the kind of rain that my young niece would call Chucky Chuck. Like, it really went for it. And then there was red flags. Then you had to wait for ages to the race to restart. And then when it did start, it started under a safety car. So it was a rolling start. A lot of people were demanding a proper standing start. And that didn't happen. And then we had Lando. Then Oscar overtook Lando. And then he was kind of struggling with his tyres a little bit. But then also, nothing really happened in the race.
You're right to a certain extent. I mean, I loved watching it because I love seeing Formula One cars go around Spa. It is still a beautiful circuit and it's still a great challenge, but when it's wet, of course, there's even more of a challenge. I thought what Oscar Piastri did was stunning. That opening lap, absolutely superb, and the way then he looked after his, you say, medium tires that he had. Lando the only one on the hard tires, you know, trying to catch up at the end, but Piastri delivered it so well. Lando making a couple of little errors. There was some interesting stuff going on. Hamilton coming from the back, I thought that was very impressive, what he had done. And also further down the order, I noticed that with Nico Hülkenberg, he was actually making a few passes at the end, even though he was one of the few who'd made a second stop late in. I almost feel if they'd done it a lap earlier, Nico Hülkenberg could have got back in the points. Who knows? But there was a lot going on, and I'm sure we've got some good questions.
Well, we do, because I mean, we are, as always, going to go over to producer Jim, who always gives us interesting things to talk about. But before we do that, can I quickly bring up the fact that they started the race an hour later than what they were supposed to because it was raining. But why have wet tyres if you're not going to use them? I understand this is obviously a Pirelli issue, but everyone was just then opting for Inters. What's the point in having a wet option if the wets aren't good enough?
Well, I think it depends on the circuit to a certain extent as well. And there's no doubt that when we saw them go out behind the safety car, the amount of spray and the lack of vision, that was pretty crucial.
Well, Max wanted to go out though, didn't he?
He did, of Max course. Was Max fuming. Wanted to be out earlier. I understand that.
Producer Jim, go on.
Okay, you do surprise me with your support for Max. Okay, so rain was predicted all week. Surprise, surprise, it rains at Spa. An hour rain delay replaced by sunshine. And the track dries really quickly after a few laps under the safety car, but yet no standing starts. What was the safety car really needed? No. Discuss.
It should have been a standing start. It should have been. I mean, you watch all of the interviews with all the drivers afterwards, and it just felt like it was the right thing to go for a standing start. Clearly, the clips of all of the drivers while they were just waiting for the red flag to finish for them to be able to go out, they were happy to go out. I know that there were moans and stuff from other drivers saying the visibility was pretty tricky. But at the same time, Max Verstappen is like, why can't we just go racing. This is just what we do. Otherwise, cancel every wet race. What's the point?
Max was the keen one, and it was partly because that car was set up for the wet. And
because he's good in the wet.
Yeah, well, he is good in the wet. And I do understand his opposition to the fact that it took so long before they...
Is it because every driver would then know that Max was then going to win this race? So if enough people moan about it, then the FIA can go, all right, fine, we'll hold on to the red flag a little bit longer because we know that Max will win it if everyone moans about it enough.
He's not the only star in the wet. Lewis Hamilton's a star in the wet, but he was starting so far back.
Yeah.
But no, I feel a bit split about it too, because I would love to have seen a standing start, and I think that would have been fascinating. Really, the opening of the race would have been interesting. But I do understand from the safety point of view, there have been dangers at Spa, and there have been issues, and the visibility when we were watching them go around behind the safety car with the spray coming up, with these modern F1 cars, the way the spray comes up, the vision is really poor. And so I kind of understand why they went for that rolling start rather than a standing start, but I would have loved to have seen a standing start, and I do hope in the future that they would tend to go more that way.
Yeah. Producer Jim.
Okay, Lando made a critical errors in the safety car start and Oscar passes him on the first lap. How impressive and crucial was that pass? Discuss.
Oh, yeah, really crucial. I mean, there's now, 16 points between them?
Indeed, that's right.
It looks like, I mean, from what we can pretty much all predict, it feels like Oscar has this in the bag. He just seems cool as a cucumber and just ready to win this world championship, whereas Lando just keeps making those little slip-ups. It just feels like it's Oscar's championship to win.
It was absolutely superb what Oscar did, and I tend to agree with you. And the way you hear that smoothness on the radio when he's talking to his team is so calm. And he had to hold on for a long time, and there's no doubt Lando was catching him towards the end. But his first lap, what he did on that opening lap, as Jim was saying, was fantastic. I mean, really impressive. Yes, I know at Spa it can often be an advantage not to be first off the line because you've then got the opportunity to get the toe. But I have to say Piastri did it brilliantly. The outbraking in damp conditions, he didn't run wide, he didn't go off. Very, very impressive. And Lando's going to have to watch out because, you know, he's done a couple of very good events just recently. But the way that Oscar just came back at him, took that victory, impressive.
There was a good meme that I saw online, and it was the quote from Zach Brown, who said, oh, we've had the Schumacher era, we've had the Lewis era, we've had the Max era, now it's time for the Lando Norris era. And then it cuts to the clip of Oscar Piastri's awkward face like that. Staring. So good, because it's clearly the Oscar Piastri era. It just is.
Well, we'll see. We've still got plenty more to find out.
Producer Jim.
Also, just on that, just before we cover that off, obviously the pass was very important for the pit stop strategy, because he got tyres first.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, absolutely. Piastri had the choice on that pit stop. Yeah, he went back onto medium tyres. I thought it was interesting that McLaren went for the hard tyres on Lando Norris.
Yeah.
And you could see that pace he had at the end certainly was good, but he did make a couple of little errors. If he hadn't made those, could he have been that little closer? I think he would have been a little closer. Mm. So it was a challenge, but there's no doubt getting in front, that gives you the order to the team as to who comes in first, and that was a big bonus for Piastri.
Producer Jim.
Terrible Saturday, impressive Sunday. Lewis Hamilton back to his old battling self in mixed conditions, and a good Ferrari strategy call too. Shock horror.
I can't believe it.
Could this be the start of better things in the second half of the season? Discuss.
I hope so, but we've had some of these. We've discussed this a lot now, of Lewis doing well and then not doing well, then doing well, and we go, oh, maybe this is the moment, and then it doesn't happen. Maybe it's now, and then it doesn't happen. But that was a great race for Lewis, starting from the pit lane, finishing P7. That was solid.
It was very good, and especially after awful qualifying, you know, for both sprint and the main race, he ended up down at the back. I mean, that was disappointing to see, and you could see how disappointed he was as well, especially making that little mistake in the main qualifying where he just ran over the white line and got a time taken away when he should have moved up through the order. So it was great to see what Lewis Hamilton did on Sunday in the race itself. And they've got this new rear suspension on the Ferrari. And I think it probably is helping now. They needed that to make the car a bit more balanced, a bit more controlled. And the way that Leclerc was able to fend off Verstappen throughout that whole race, it maybe gives me just that they are gaining a little bit more confidence with that car. Let's hope that they can do that going forward.
Are they though?
Well, let's see.
Are they?
I don't know. Is it enough? Is it enough?
I don't know. It just feels like you have just so many promising moments of just like, oh, mate, it's Ferrari's moment. And then it just goes back down again. So who knows what Hungary's going to bring. Right. Producer Jip.
Okay. A new discussion point I'm calling Life After Christian. Red Bull start a new era with a sprint race win for Max. Yuki seems happier. And then the Grand Prix was more of the same with Max 4th and Yuki 12th. How do you think they did without Captain Christian? Discuss.
Well, it's a question for you, Nicola.
I mean, it feels like good energy, doesn't it? It does feel like good energy. Now we've got Laurent Mekies in place. It was really lovely to see all four Red Bull cars, including the Racing Bulls, in Q3. There's clearly a nice team morale going on. Everyone's feeling pretty great. I'm not going to say that's anything negative against Christian, but I think maybe they've taken a bit of time. The team have now come together and now it just feels like a more collective teamwork that's going on. So I think this could be a positive.
Okay, interesting. I mean, Max Verstappen taking the win in the sprint race was key, of course. And that was impressive what he did. No doubt about it. The way he had to fend off the McLarens throughout the rest of the race, and he did it really, really well. And as you say, there was a good atmosphere. But I don't think you can sort of say too early, oh, Laurent Mekies. I like Laurent Mekies, and he's good on the engineering side as well, understands it very well. How this is going to go forwards, that's a big question, because the team at the moment is how Christian Horner had set it up for many years. Yeah. It's got the people there. It takes time. It takes months as a new boss.
It's 20 years versus one race.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a little early to make too many decisions, but it will be fascinating to see how Red Bull goes in the future.
It's exciting. Producer Jim.
Okay. Honourable rookie mentions. Bortoletto and Lawson in the points. And Ollie Bearman scores his fourth straight 11th place finish. How frustrating must that be? Discuss.
So frustrating for him. Bless him. And also, can I just give a shout out to Liam Lawson? Because they're now calling Liam points as loints. That's now a social media thing. So we had loints. It's very exciting for Liam.
Yeah, he's doing a good
rookie
job.
Day.
No, yeah, Liam's doing a good job. And I'm glad to see the confidence is coming back, because he'd had a tough start to the year.
Yeah.
So that's good news. There's no doubt about it. And yeah, for Ollie Bearman, I do feel sorry for him a little bit that he has missed out on the points again, because he's doing a good job.
So close.
Yeah, so close. But he is doing well.
Yeah. Oh, and also having a little look at our social media roundup, talking of Christian Horner, he's been horse riding. Now look, he has always had horses and racing horses, him and Jerry, together. But I don't know if this is now just like a new business venture for him. But he's been posting a lot about being on his horses and stuff. Maybe he's just having a bit of downtime. But also, I did see on Sky Sports F1, they were interviewing Toto. And even Toto's like, I don't think he's gone forever. I feel like he could come back. So maybe he's just popping out on the horses, having a jolly old time. And then he could be back, and who knows where.
Be fascinating to see, wouldn't it?
Predictions?
I haven't really got a prediction as yet. Him disappearing completely, that does feel a bit strange.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah. Make sure you follow wherever you're listening on your podcast platform. And if you're watching on YouTube, then don't forget to subscribe. And give us your thoughts of the race just gone as well in the comments section below. Also, this episode of Midweek F1 is brought to you by Diamond Bright, protecting, cleaning and caring for cars since 1992.
Well, now it's time for our very special guest, former F1 driver and inspiration to Brad Pitt's character in the new F1 movie. Please welcome Martin Donnelly. Martin, it's so lovely to have you with us.
Guys, thank you for having me here today. It's been great so far.
Now, obviously, we are going to be discussing the F1 movie very shortly. I do need to bring up, first of all, you know, when sometimes if someone was to say, who would you like to play you in a movie? I feel like universally everyone would say Brad Pitt, but you've actually had that happen to you.
Oh, there you go.
That's crazy.
No, better man for the job.
That's crazy. Like, yeah, go for Brad Pitt, you know. Yes. But we're going to discuss that a little bit more later on. But from the movie, from people that have seen it, people know and have an idea of how your F1 career ended. But how did it begin?
I forgot that much time.
Loads of time.
Obviously, it happened quite quickly when EJ became my manager, my mentor, my friend. And it was him that pushed me forward to Peter Collins at Lotus at the early part of 89. And we signed a contract with them. So we had a bit of testing during the course of the year, which obviously left them with no doubt that I should be signed as a driver for the 1990 season, alongside Derek Warwick, who had previously had a contract with Lotus back in the day, and then stepped out in Senna. He came to their doorstep, and they obviously were quite keen to have Ayrton, and unfortunately Ayrton didn't want Warwick there, because Warwick had been in F1 since 19, somebody will quote me otherwise, so 1981, I think it was, and he was then let go.
Going forward, you had all these different possibilities of contracts?
Or had options, good options.
You had different options.
Who were paying reasonable money. Of course, EJ, first contract offering me was all me. And I said, EJ, you need to come and match by second-year terms in Lotus. Otherwise, I'll go and sign with Jackie Oliver or Ken Turrell.
That must have been amazing, because EJ had helped you in your early career before that, hadn't he?
Yeah, yeah. But, you know,
Eddie Jordan, we're talking about.
His new team, you know, there was a lack of F1 personnel there. Maybe Trevor Foster had been there before, but, you know, there was nobody there had ever experienced, and he brought in Gary Anderson as a designer. You know, that's a big question mark, and all that risk was on my side of the desk, where I could go elsewhere where there was less risk and getting a higher remuneration. So EJ came back with a third offer, which is several months down the road, which we could have done something with at the time.
Interesting.
That must be a weird experience for you, being so in demand like that.
Well, from your side of the desk, not so much mine. You know, I've been taught well by EJ, you know, always say no and then come back at a different angle. So I was beating EJ with his own reverse psychology, you know. So I knew I had options, and he brought me down to Brands Hatch at the F3000 meeting there in his motorhome, which obviously done some sort of dodgy deal with somewhere along the way. And they produced his third contract, which you go through it that weekend. And, you know, apart from... There was a bit of maneuverability there that we could have done, that I could have turned around and said, okay, we'll go with this. But having Jackie Oliver, where I did my first Grand Prix with in 89, a deal done by EJ and with Ken Turrell, we had the Pirelli tires back then, which was a big, big plus. I wasn't that desperate to design with EJ. But, you know, thankfully, Lotus, on the morning of my accident, took that option away, and they signed me for strong money and to be number one driver, choice of a second car. We have a car set up for the wet and the dry, or different stages of qualifying. Best tires, best engines. You know, that's hard to say no to.
Well, of course, the crash that you had in Jerez was horrific. What are your memories of that day, of what happened, and then tell us a little bit about how the recovery came afterwards.
Recovery took a year and a half. Well, that's a different story, which obviously takes a lot longer to explain. But the weekend before was the Portuguese Grand Prix. So we didn't fly back to the UK. We stayed out. We flew, I think, Lisbon, Madrid, Alicante. And then we had friends there, NJ Devon, and Ed ran Ed's calf back in the day. So anybody that drove for Van Diemen that was on the doorstep, he always fed them. Ayrton being one of those, and myself and Tommy Byrne and all the guys over the years. He was very much a motorsport enthusiast. And so he went up to Harvia, up to a village he hadn't built at the time. So he looked at that, and then we had spent 3 or 4 days on the beach down in Harvia. Quite nice. And of course, this fair-skinned Irishman got himself sunburnt, which wasn't a good thing to do going into a Grand Prix that weekend coming, but the seatbelt's been put down on your burnt shoulders and all the rest of that. So that gives some of my physiotherapist guys to look after at the time. And, you know, back then we had these two yellow Vespa scooters. So I took my fiancée Diane on the back of mine, and then Jenny followed me on theirs, and we'd stop off at various corners. I'd say, this one's second gear, third gear, but you want the team to do a spot on the circuit where they could see 3 or 4 corners together, because it was quite hilly, but you couldn't see it around the back of the circuit, blah, blah, blah. So we stopped on a fence where you could see coming to the last third turn into the second last and into the hairpin. And ironically, that's where I ended up having my accident, which is straight in front of them. And Ed, obviously, again, a guy fed back in the day, a guy called Roberto Moreno, who was ex-Van Diemen. He stood with Ed because he hadn't pre-qualified that morning off. I think back then there was about 18 cars were in the pre-qualifying. And obviously, Jordan, being the first year, had to go through that hurdle as well, which is all very sort of, it's like a minefield. If you get something wrong, you didn't pre-qualify. And that was you, pack up, go home. And so Ed was trying to get over this fence to get to me. And Roberto was about the size of 5'6", like a jockey, was pulling Ed off the fence. He said, no, he'll be fine, and pulling him back. And of course, then it got red flagged, and Jenny then ran back to the pit lane to tell my fiance Diane, had an accident. Of course, she ran to the motorhome with a very low wing mirror. She fell back, split her head open, and the time you got to the pit lane, she was covered in blood. She was in partial shock. And she tried to explain to Diane, Martin's had this accident, that's why he's been red flagged. So it went quiet for quite some time, and there I was, like a rag doll in the middle of a track.
So I think you were going, it was probably about 176
to be exact, yes.
And I mean, obviously that's stupidly quick, and that must have just gone like that.
You could say
or
that.
Or did it happen in slow motion, near-death experience?
Click a finger, because you're doing that speed, or you're on qualifying tires with qualifying fuel. And, you know, part of my job is trying to make that tire last to get you the good traction at the last corner. But more often, these tires were like super glue. You know what I mean? For example, Silverstone. You go into Cops, which was the first corner back in the day, and you do that, say, in a test day, 60 times, it's hard brakes, down the fifth, down the fourth, in there, bit of a power slide, up onto the exit, was a high curb that saved the oversteer, and as you come off that curb, up the fifth and sixth down to Beckett's. You put a set of Q tires on, and your whole mind has to do a mental readjust, because you're coming out of there now quicker out of the old luff field, because you're getting good traction, you're in second gear, and it's like a launch on the qualifying fuel. So you're getting down the Cops at a quicker speed, and with a dab in the brakes, down the fifth, flat.
Yeah, completely different. So instead of going down two gears, you're just going down one, much lighter on the brake.
Carry a lot more speed in the corner, a lot earlier on the throttle, and you come off the corner, you think, I could have done that quicker.
I made it.
Yeah, could have done it quicker.
So at Jerez, when it went wrong, that's the sort of thing you were doing. Yeah. Into that corner, it was that last minute.
Quicker.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, one mechanic, the number two mechanic, hadn't spotted that the bell crank that's bonded under the carbon tub, we had a step in the tub then, which then goes out to the dampers that lay parallel on the floor, sculpted in, covered by a glass fibre shroud that's attached to the dampers. It's like a coat hanger. You bend a coat hanger, a metal one, as fast as you can. It'll always break where the most friction is and the hottest part is. And that part for my car was the damper neck on the left-hand side, because all clockwise, the damper neck on the right side, the very little left-hand corners. And it broke just as I turned into that corner. And the armor coat barrier, there's no gravel trap, there's no tire barrier, it's just metal. And I hit that on one of the joists that supports the armor coat barrier. And when I hit that, it was like an explosion. The car broke like a bomb, because they took the weight out of the tub, because we had a V12 engine that year, whereas the car previous was a Judd V8. So the weight from the V8 to the 12-cylinder engine was heavier. I couldn't tell you how many kilos, but Frank Durney, the designer, had to find a way of getting that weight back again, and that was in the tub. And ironically, and sounds strange to say, thankfully, I went with that inertia, and I went with the energy, whereas with Ayrton and with Roland, they didn't get that opportunity. They hit the concrete head on, and they both broke their necks. And thankfully, I went with that. Okay, I broke most things in the body, and a lot of internal injuries that went into shock. But as Sid Wogan said, bones were always a healer themselves. He knew my body was going to shock within 3 days. So they transferred me to Seville, and he knew I had to come out of there on the Tuesday night to his helipad on at the hospital, at the Royal London Hospital in the East End. And the very next day, as he preempted, the body just closed down into shock, which put me into a respirator for 7 weeks and kidney dialysis every day for 3 hours.
Gosh. I mean, but of course, I was just thinking, I mean, with the film, in the film that, you know, they've,
yes,
with Brad Pitt, of course, he comes back to Formula One. You wanted to come back to Formula One. That was, yes, very much in your head, wasn't it?
Well, I almost believed in my head.
Yeah.
I was going to get there.
But yes, it didn't happen.
No. It did happen because I burst an artery on the track, and then they put me into traction on the leg. I think 16 pins, and so that just stays straight the whole time. And when you bend your leg, your femur moves up and down, and their muscle moves up and down your femur. Hmm. And because this is solid, give me your hand, I feel that. That's rock hard.
Oh, God, it actually is.
Yeah, yeah. That's all scar tissue and, yeah, in there.
So I don't need to keep touching your leg. But it, I'm going to keep touching your leg there.
I like this interview. It's going well. It's going well so far.
That's really weird.
Yeah.
And so it's solid. Yeah. And we had quadplasties, two of those done, a couple of years in between, and I got 40% bend in the first one, and they tore the skin across the knee. Come back 3 years later, went for it again and got 120 degrees. And for me, that would be enough for me to ride a bike and perhaps play a bit of football with my young kids. But they tore the skin again, and that was it. And you get to a stage in life after umpteen operations and recovery and disappointments, and you say to yourself, I mean, technically I died three times on the track,
yeah,
first time, and then twice operating table, with having to stand by and come into the jump release and get me go started again. And even said, walking, said to my mother, there's a very religious woman, and said, look, we don't think Martin will survive through the night, so if you've got your faith and you've got your God, please pray to God. And she went and got the priest from the hospital and came in and gave me the last rites. And here I am, a very determined, stubborn young man, and we can hear her talk about it.
But, I mean,
amazing.
I mean, the footage of the crash and the aftermath of watching you lay on the track is really traumatizing to, mm-hmm, see as a viewer. But how much of it is actually your memory versus what everyone told you what happened? Because basing that accident that Brad Pitt had in the film, how much could you actually relay to Brad as your own memory versus the information that you was given? Because at the time you were laying on the track for like 11 and a half minutes or something, just, yeah, people were assuming that you were dead.
Well, if you could see that footage, you'll see there's quite a few what look like marshals. They're actually doctors in blue overalls, and it says doctor on the overalls. But the main man from the medical centre was Professor Sam Watkins, a neurosurgeon. And it was his word to the FIA that anybody on track, any accidents, nobody touches him because he's in charge. Now, he was in a Trabant at the pit lane exit, and I was more or less lying at the pit lane entry.
Yeah.
So it took him 11 and a half, it took him more than 11 minutes to get there. By the time he got to me and sort of sussed out what happened, I opened my visor, he could see I was asphyxiated, so he knew my airways were blocked. So he got me, I got my teeth, I got my tongue up from my throat and got me stabilised. Unbeknown to him, over his right shoulder, Senna was there, taking him out from the pit lane to watch what was going on. And I think there's some pictures of Senna when Sid took the helmet off me, he offered it up, and Senna took it for a while. And he watched Sid do his thing in the order that he did it, from experience. Got me straight, got my legs. And bear in mind, there's a lot of blood because the femur had come out the left side of the leg. There's a burst artery there, you know. So Sid had to get me, what's I'm looking for, get me stabilised, is the word I'm looking for. So that was, I could be transferred to the medical centre and then more drugs and get me fit to travel in her ambulance. And so they flew me to Seville. After that, Senna went back out again and went round the fastest lap ever in Jerez. So he just watched a young lad he could relate to. Massive, and I heard him back in the early 80s, used to go out and fly his motor controlled cars and his aircraft at Snetterton. And we had some lunches and dinners together. So there's a distant friendship there. So he watched this guy. So he went back and got qualifying. He then had to, under the FIA rule, go and do the post-qualifying interview. She walked in and told the world's press to say, I'm not going to take any questions from the floor today, but I'm going to explain to you guys what I, why I did, why I did, and what I did it for. And then he went to see Sid Watkins, asked why he'd done things he did, had a bit of a snack, and then drove the 40 minutes down to Seville to the hospital and found where I was in the intensive care unit. There was a young lad there, a good friend of mine, a guy called Mark Gallagher. We grew up together in Irish motorsport. We used to always take him to Kirkuson and sometimes to Mandela Park. And then I came to England to race. He came to England to be a journalist. And we went up the ranks together. So he worked for a lot of the tobacco companies and for A. Jordan, who didn't. And he was there to report back to the press corps at Jerez, if or not I had died or had survived. And Senna said to Mark, when he wasn't allowed into their actual room, but he just looked through the window and said to Mark, look, he said, if the Donnelly family need any help, be it financial or contacts, just contact him. He said, I'll pay for the miracle, their ambulance back to the UK. And that was the sort of guy he was, you know.
It's amazing that this F1 movie has used, you know, what happened to you. How did you get involved in that? And then were you involved in the film itself?
Pretty much so, yes.
Yeah?
Behind closed doors. It all came from a phone call I received from Lewis Hamilton. Back in, he's actually at the race in Azerbaijan, Baku. And it was a Saturday evening. And I'm in the with the family watching this, my phone go with hell call. And I thought, oh, here we go. It's going to be somebody trying to send me some bifold doors or bifold windows, or do you want to have your house re-insulated? And I've gone, just to be aggressive, get on the phone and said, hello, who's that? And this guy, hi, it's Lewis. Who is it? And I said, it's Lewis. Lewis who? And he says, Lewis Hamilton. I said, oh, backwards. Grovel a bit. And he wasn't there then, I don't think, at that stage.
Oh, right, okay.
And I said, look, and I says, what's the story? He said, well, I'm out here at the Grand Prix where there's talk about putting together an F1 movie. We very much like to use your accent as part of the movie and blah, blah, blah. And we bit of I don't know, I said from us not often I said my phone call takes a phone call from 7-time world champions in the past, you know. And I saw a bit more humble, a bit more sheepish. And I said, yes, I haven't got a problem with that, Lewis. That's very nice to be asked. Because they were going to use initially the Imola accent of Gerhard Burgers.
Mm. Right.
The big fiery accent where he had fingers and burnt and everything else. But then Lewis suggested to Joseph Kolisky that about my accent, and they watched that and he said, that's what I'm going to use. So Ian Moore at the end said, look, I'm saying yes. I said, you get your people to call my people and we'll come to a remuneration that justifies the accent or not. So and within a week, I was at Silverstone at the mock-up studio they built there in the wing paddock. I sat down in front of Joseph Kolisky and we got a bit of chit-chat. No, I didn't tell him the whole truth, nothing but the truth. I knew it wasn't in my interest to tell him the whole truth, nothing but the truth about how much you remember. So I did waffle a little bit on that for a while. And let's say contracts were signed and remuneration was being paid on a monthly basis.
So then I never
go to heaven.
So then the filming has started, and from our perspective as fans, they were filming that film for a very, very long time. So when it came to them shooting at Silverstone, etc., did you go along to kind of help out with them on track? How soon was it that you got to meet Brad? And does he look as handsome as he does in real life?
In your eyes. Yeah. I met him the first time when I met with Joseph. He was, they put a radio call out to get Brad to come to the unit, and he walked in. And he just, hey man, he said, you're my hero. I said, I've watched your documentary and I've watched the accent. He says, how the hell is you actually here?
Yeah.
It's Brad Pitt. And you know, after the more you get to know Brad, the more time you spend in his company, you know. He's like us. He's an actor. I'm a racing driver. We all are different jobs and we all do our jobs as best we can.
Yeah.
And that's how I got to meet him. And then we had to reenact the accident. So several months down the road, Apex had a massive studio at Aylesbury, massive big warehouse divided into various sections. And I was up there talking to various people, getting to meet various people. And then they were shooting these scenes out in the car park, if you like, where it was. And they had this mannequin in yellow overalls with an orange blue helmet, with a harness strapped around it, with cameras in the helmet, cameras on the mannequin. And then they start stacking bodywork, suspension bits and pieces, bits of bodywork, and then a bag of concrete, which is concrete dust. And then they had these 80-odd cameras, and this harness was attached to a cable to a guy about 100 yards away with a nitrous bottle. All on walkie-talkies. I said, we're going to create a scene, get thanked to everybody on a countdown, 10, 90, 70, and then this guy would hit this nitrous bottle, this button, and then this man got launched into the air, and all these cameras were taking these shots and stills, and then would land flat and then get dragged across the concrete. And I'm going, great guys, but that's not how it happened. So here's a picture of the accident. Now you're actually rolling across the track. So obviously, I was, how do I put it, doing my Eddie Jordan bit. No. That's not faking, right? That's not how it happened. This is how it happened. Look at these pictures. And of course, every scene, I was getting quite handsomely paid for that. And so 15 scenes in 3 hours, I was well paid. I said, look, I got to be somewhere else, but I got a meeting this afternoon, and going and came back. When I went to watch the premiere, I was looking forward to seeing myself, these mannequins, die 15, 16 times. And there it was, the actual accent that was portrayed at the time, except I ate my helmet from Brad's helmet onto mine and turned it blue. So all these things they did beforehand was on the cutting room floor. Wow. They didn't use it.
Yeah. Was there... I could just talk to you forever. Was that quite traumatising for you, though, having to like relive the accident over and over and over again? Aside from the fact that they were paying you handsomely.
Yes.
Was that quite traumatising, going, no, this is exactly what it was like, this is actually what I experienced, and having to go back to that moment?
Not really, because you don't remember it.
Oh, right, I suppose,
yeah. And the thing is, I asked Sid Watkins, the surgeon at the time, I said, why can I remember? He says, because he says it's your positive half of your brain protecting you from the negative half. Back then, I was, 25, and I had a lot of dreams. Everybody has dreams. And people have deja vu. And I can say, with hand on heart, that since that accident in Jerez, I go to bed and it's like a light switch. It's light switch off, I go to sleep, light switch on. There's no dreaming, there's no deja vu.
Wow.
Whatever goes on inside my head just stops. I like to put a polygraph in there just to see if it actually does die again, then reawaken when the alarm goes off. But it's a surreal thing, because like my kids say, oh, I had a strange dream last night. I said, you're very lucky. He said, I have no dreams. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the accent that you portray. I have this constant injury to my left leg. My left leg's now the best part of 2 inches shorter than my right leg. I walk with a limp, and that's the price you pay for that, you know. And
amazing.
You get on that, and your body learns to cope. And I'm not too good with slopes and stairs, but your body copes with that.
Remarkable.
It's all part of life. You get on with it.
Martin, you're amazing.
What did you think of the film?
I thought it was very good. I think it's personally. I think it obviously has to be dramatised for not so much the American audience, but the worldwide audience. And, you know, obviously Sonny has this accent and is like Control-Alt-Delete. They forget that, comes back as fixed, and carries on with his Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Obviously my life, in real life, didn't happen. I wish there was a Control-Alt-Delete for me.
Course.
But
of course.
Because I tried for the best part of 2.5 years to get back into that.
I know.
But reality check, I'm here to talk about it. I've got 3 good kids, Steph and Short Noan. I love them dearly, and they're a very important part of my life. I got a new lady in my life called Sue, and life goes on.
You've done remarkably.
I was speaking to Sue earlier, and she said, it's very lovely that you now smell like Brad Pitt. So he gave you some aftershave?
We got a hamper from Brad. It comes on a regular basis, his champagne and his wines, his honeys and his aftershave, yes. It's all part of the package. Wrote into my contract.
Love it.
Leave that. Give me something.
Well, Martin, your story of life is incredible, but we've got to try and bring this back.
I want to be here and talk about this for another hour.
But we've got to bring this back to modern Formula One, and we want some of your opinions on some of this as well. And we have we need to talk about every time we do this podcast, we do this. We need to talk about. Right. And one of the things I want to ask you about is one of the rookies actually who's been doing well to a certain extent, but just recently it hasn't gone so well for Kimi Antonelli. He did well at Miami earlier on this year. He had a podium in Canada, but since then the results have dropped away a little. We've got a bunch of rookies. What are your thoughts on Kimi in particular at this stage? Because we're getting to a stage in the season where the teams will be deciding what to do next year and beyond, because through August that's often when the new driver contracts are done.
Correct. I think Kimi's got a great talent. He is prone to mistakes. Look, last year when he had his free practice one at, I think it was Imola.
Monza,
yeah. Yeah. Mm. He fell off on that. But obviously, trying maybe a bit too hard or inexperienced. And I do think that, you know, he's not doing anything overly wrong that more time behind the steering wheel won't cure. Mm. Because the talent's there, he just needs to learn and progress. And the more time he gets that chance to progress, the better he'll get. And the fewer mistakes he'll make. And I think one of the things, sounds wrong to say this, one thing that stands in his favour is he's a lot cheaper than the other drivers in the market at the moment for Toto. So, you know, he's progressing. He's learned from, you know, his mistake at the first Grand Prix this year in Melbourne. And more miles and more seat time will make him better, as did with Coulthard, as did with Mansell, and with a certain extent with Damon. You know, give him his time and he'll come good.
We've been learning, by the way, that Max Verstappen is unlikely to drop down the order enough that he can leave the Red Bull contract easily. That's some of the new news in a way, understandably, because even if we go to the next race, even if he doesn't score, he won't drop that far down
he's
in the championship.
He's just too good.
Yeah.
So basically you're saying he's stealing himself off the market.
Well, is he on the market or, you know, is he staying at Red Bull now? Do you think that's it?
I always say every man has his price.
Yeah.
And these massive corporations, you know, seems to be money has no object. But Max is not racing for money anymore. You know, how good is the Red Bull Ford engine going to be next year?
Nobody
knows. You've got the new fuels coming in, new aeros. Now Adrian Newey's left, gone to Aston Martin. There's a lot of them there. And it's not just down to one question. You know, it's up down to the package. I always say in life, you make a cake, each cake has an ingredient, certain amount of flour, certain amount of sugar, blah, blah, blah. And if you get one of those ingredients wrong, that cake won't rise. Mm-hmm. F1's exactly the same. Everything has to be
just
spot on.
Yeah.
You have to get the ingredients right, with engines, with tyres, how the chassis after those tyres, and your drivers. And it's a very complex science, but if one of those ingredients isn't there, no matter how good your driver is, he won't get that car to the front.
It's also a tricky situation because of the whole new regulations coming in next season. Mm-hmm. No one knows who's going to be where. No one knows who's going to be the stronger team because it's a whole new ball game for every single team. So it feels like if anyone's going to move this season, that might just be a bad move. So you kind of want to wait a year just to kind of see where everyone's at next season before you then make any decisions.
Some guys are a contract at the end of this year.
Mm.
So you have to go back on fundamental basics when the hybrids come in.
Yeah.
Who got it right? You have to say Merckxberg on the ball straight away. And they've always come to the fore. And there's certain teams get it right and some certain teams get it wrong because you need to have the right engineers, the right aerodynamicists, the right designers, the right wind tunnels. And it's a matter of what team you think, before you prepare the paper, have got a certain amount of those things in the right place at the right time.
Mm.
And that's why I've been placing my decisions on, as a driver.
Where would you go?
Where I go, I can't say that at this moment in time because I signed the NDA for part two of the movie. Go on.
Oh, look forward to that. Okay, now we need to start looking forward to the next Grand Prix coming up this weekend, the Hungarian Grand Prix. Mm. Just a general thought, we will get into a bit more detail of what we actually think, who might be where in a moment, but just in general thoughts, Hungary, from your point of view, Martin, I know it's a track that you consider quite well.
And yes. I have my best slot there. Yeah. P7, because the issue we have at the time, you don't need top-end speed. You don't need to a certain amount great aerodynamics. There's no really high-speed corners in the track.
Right.
What you need in Hungary is good front end and great traction. And you have to look at, it's like it's a mini Monaco, all right? Mm. And my mind goes back to Monaco this year. Okay, the teams have developed cars bit by bit, but more so for high-speed corners. And you've got to look back who was on the front row and second row in Monaco back in May, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it was May, yeah.
So this is going to be part of your prediction, is it? Because yeah, Nicola, we need to start talking about this.
Diana goes first, no?
Right.
On,
we have first. The prediction championship of the world. Yes. Allow me to set things up for you. So we have myself, Ben, producer Jim, and team guest now. Last time on the show, we had Rachel Brooks from Sky F1, and she scored a whole lot of nothing.
Zero.
Gazette. So, here is the grid as it stands. We've got a joint first, team guest, and Ben with 49 Yay. Points. You've got mega points.
I'm astonished.
You got 6 points for Oscar, so you're now joint top, which none of us saw coming at the start of the season.
No,
you
I
had
didn't.
A terrible
no, I've
start.
Been at the bottom all the time.
And then there's producer Jim with 48 points because you scored 10 points from last week.
Smash.
Very well played.
Yeah,
and
very good.
I'm now in last. With 44, because I also scored a whole lot of nothing.
We're all pretty close, though, right. On the points.
Yes. So here's how it works. Prediction Championship of the World, brought to you by Diamond Bright, manufacturing car care products in the UK since 1992. You get 6 points if you get P1 right, 4 for P2, 2 for P3, and then you get a point for fastest lap. We know that fastest lap doesn't exist in F1 anymore, but we include it in this podcast. So we need P1, P2, P3, fastest lap. Over to you.
Well, I think it's a driver circuit. It is a driver can make the difference. We've seen that in time over time. And I think based on last weekend's produce, I mean, Red Bull and Jos aren't too far away. Max, who says, sorry, Max is not too far away.
You'll also be keeping an eye on him.
Yas did have his chance there and didn't perform. So I'd say, going back on that, that I think Max will be on pole.
Okay.
For the race. If it's dry, hopefully it'll stay dry. And then I think, you know, it's going to be a fight, a toss-up between the two McLaren drivers. And I'm going to put Oscar second and Lando third.
Okay. That's how they finish. That's how you
that's the qualifying.
That's qualifying. Now, but what about the finish?
Race. Finish, I think, again, Max.
Yeah.
I'll stick with my prediction. I'd maybe throw in a Leclerc there towards the end. I'll throw in Max, Oscar, Leclerc.
Okay. Ooh. And fastest lap for who?
Fastest lap. Ooh, there's a draw card. I'd say for,
can be anybody, really, can't it?
It can be anybody. Let's go Lewis.
Okay, Lewis Hamilton, yeah. Okay.
Ben?
Oh, it's me next, is it?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Okay, well, I'm going to go for Oscar Piastri taking the win because he took the win last year and he's very impressive at the moment. I am going to go for Max second, actually, because I think he's going to find a way of getting in between or somewhere, and Lando third. Fastest lap, I'm going to go for Hamilton as well, actually, because he does go well.
Copycat, there. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm going to go for Max P1. That's not because I have a Red Bull contract. It's just because I'm copying
yes,
Martin.
Yes, it is.
I'm just copying Martin. It's fine. I'm
going to use some Brad Pitt perfume.
I'm going to go P2 Lando.
Okay.
I base that on absolutely nothing.
No, but he's still very talented.
I just feel like it's going to be a battle between him and Oscar. And I feel like Lando's just going to pip it and then Oscar will be P3.
Yeah.
And I think fastest lap is going to go to Oscar.
Okay.
That's where I'm going. Producer Jim.
Okay. I'm going to go Oscar first. I think he's on the roll.
Yep.
Lando second, same repeat of last year. And Leclerc third, because I think Ferrari have good...
Yeah.
Good at Monaco, weren't they? He was good at Monaco. And I'm going to go Max fastest lap.
Fair enough. I think that's a good choice.
Solid.
Good
choice. Interesting. Well, bring on next week and then we'll find out who got on and who scored a whole lot of nothing. I'm hoping that I score some points this week because I don't like being last. I can't handle it. Right. Here's what we do on this podcast, Martin. This all started just from randomly from episode one, is we like to round up the show with either an interesting fact or a fun little story. Ooh. So whatever you've got, hit us.
Well, I want to speak about my good friend EJ. I think he's touched a lot of lives in motorsport, certainly mine. I always say he was my mentor, my manager, my best friend. And I go back, ironically, to Jerez. I think we're testing there in F3000. And somehow myself and EJ ended up in a twin room. No doubt, I was paying for it because this would have been on the tab when they kept running from month to month. And I'm in the shower. Well, my hairstyle there wasn't like it is now. It used to be like curtains back in the early 90s was the fashion back then.
Nice.
And so he's on the bed in his boxer short, and he was very hairy. I mean, he was like an ape all over.
Not very aerodynamic.
He had nothing up here, but hairy everywhere else. And I've come out of the bathroom, and the windowsill was glistening in bright sunshine, right? And it was warm. It must be about 28 degrees. So I've gone blow dry my hair to make myself look good for whoever might meet over dinner. And I'm wrapping up my hairdryer around the lead itself. And EJ said, "Marty," he says, "leave that out for me." I said, he's on the phone to Maria. I said, "You what?" I says, "You might as well take that rug off and put it on the windowsill and let it dry by itself." He says, "Don't be so fake and cheeky." He says, "I still own you." And that was EJ, you know.
Did Lovely. He use the hairdryer to just blow dry his body?
Oh, I didn't want to stay and watch what was next. But allegedly he tried to blow dry his hair. I said, "Just take it off and put it on the windowsill." We also went to his place in Sora Grande, and he fancy pant shorts on. He dived in to swim pool and pulled himself at the other end and just wiped his head. It was like nylon wool, and all of a sudden it was dry, you know.
Oh, that's really annoying.
Yeah. I hate him already. But that was the fashion for EJ back then.
Oh, well, that's an amazing story.
That's amazing. Rest in peace.
Indeed.
I've loved every second of this podcast.
It's been remarkable. Thank you, Martin.
I've absolutely loved it.
It's really great.
Thank you very much, guys.
Really enjoyable. Good. And it's that's it. We've run out of time for the rest of this week. But of course, next week, we'll be looking into what has happened in Hungary, whether any of us are right or not.
Yeah.
And then we'll be looking forward, because there is a summer break. But then, of course, coming up will be round 15, the Dutch Grand Prix. So we will be looking ahead towards that.
Yes, we will. But yeah, there is a massive gap in between. So we're all going to have a nice little rest, indeed, which will be lovely. Martin, you have been wonderful.
Thank you, guys.
I cannot thank you enough. And I feel like I could have sat here for so much longer and heard even more stories. And I'm sure you've got plenty of them. So we're going to have to get you back on at some point.
Lots and lots.
All right. So when the sequel comes out.
Yes. Well, again, NDA, I can't answer that question.
Make sure you subscribe. So if you're listening to the podcast on any podcast platform, then click follow. If you're watching on YouTube, click subscribe, and then let us know your thoughts in the comment section below. And we'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us.